Backchat.
Your alternative to talk back.
Backchat.
On FBI Radio.
It is Saturday, the 24th of February, 2024, and you are listening to Backchat on FBI 94.5. Now, my name is Holly. I'm joined by the illustrious Nick Newling. Nick, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Now, we are broadcasting from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to elders past and present. Indigenous Australians are the oldest living culture in the world, and they've been here for more than 65,000 years, that's longer than the human settlements in Europe and the Americas, so it's an honour to be on these lands. Nick, what is coming up on the show this morning?
Well, later on, we're going to be taking a look at the increasing issue of Australia's syphilis epidemic and how the mainstream media has maybe been missing the story for the last decade.
And before that, we'll be chatting about Sydney's asbestos crisis with Shane McArdle from the Asbestos and Dust Diseases Research Institute.
Right now, though, we're going to be discussing the trending issue of doxing and the new proposal for laws to combat this digital issue.
And of course, if any of that pricked your ears, then get in touch. Has your favourite park been struck by asbestos? Text us 0409 945 945. Or you can even DM us on Instagram at BackchatFBI.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
Backchat on FBI 94.5.
Nick, as a journalist yourself, I can assume you have seen all the drama around internet doxing and the follow-up issues it can bring.
I have seen that, actually, and it really shows how rapidly the digital world is becoming a larger part of our lives. So to dive deeper on this issue, we're joined by producer Ewan Kiley.
Hey, y'all.
Hi.
Ewan, hey. Now, what is doxing for those who aren't familiar with the term?
Well, doxing is a term that refers to posting typically private or potentially incriminating information about someone via the internet with malicious intent. The term has become especially relevant at the moment with the recent debate over the ethics of doxing, where we as internet users draw a line for what serves the public interest. This also prompted the government to announce the proposal of a bill to effectively criminalise doxing.
So how could we see this proposed anti-doxing law impact regular Australians?
Well, this week I chatted to Professor Rob Kovar from RMIT about this, and he said that for the most part, these laws won't have much of an impact on regular Australians. This is because the laws are designed at filling gaps in our current cybersecurity laws, doxing only currently being illegal if it was used to commit a similar crime such as distributing revenge porn.
Well, that's good, but I understand that there may be some concern for journalists and how these laws would affect public interest journalism.
Well, as the bill is still in its drafting stage, it's hard to confidently say there won't be any form of impact to public interest journalism. However, the proposed law does aim at protecting journalists, especially when it comes to holding larger figures like politicians accountable. Where the goalposts could move is in how we define malicious intent, especially when the doxing has political motivations. Rob Kovar was able to explain this.
The Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus's line on what he thinks the laws will look like. So they'll be drafted to capture any publication for malicious purposes, someone's private or personal information without their consent. And so the key there really is malicious purposes. Now, malice is defined in law, and it's defined in 1800s law from the United Kingdom, and that's where most of Australia's understanding of what malice means comes from. And it really means intent to do injury.
There is another reason why doxing is receiving government attention, and it's because it was recently announced that the Online Safety Act was going to come under review. This is significant for any kind of affection action against doxing, due to the Act currently not addressing it at all and having minimal countermeasures for the issue. The theorised most likely solution will be adopting measures similar to those used by the UK government who've been able to combat doxing via pre-existing laws on internet harassment.
So, hypothetically, if someone in Australia was doxed by someone from another country, what would happen?
Well, that's where it gets even more complicated, due to no international laws being set. However, in an instance where the person doing the doxing is in a country that has anti-doxing laws, such as the Netherlands, then that person could be charged, but it would be by the Dutch government. So it's instances where someone is doxed by someone from a country without doxing laws, then the Australian government would have no jurisdiction. This presents a follow-up issue in the prevalence of technology such as VPNs that could mask the doxer's location, making it harder to prosecute. I discuss this further with Rob on whether this act is still relevant and where this act's flaws are impacting Australians.
the moment, the Act only makes reference to private sexual material. So, and you know, which is a form of doxing. You know, we normally think of it as revenge porn, or the technical term is technology facilitated image based abuse. So at this stage, sexualized content is the only consideration of that law. So if it's amended to include doxing, which you know, is going to be an important thing to do, it's going to help you know, move the idea that personal information is not just sexual information.
So if these laws at this stage won't be able to effectively police the practice of doxing, what is the purpose of going through with them?
Well, at this stage, the intention of the proposed bills is purely preventative. It has already been acknowledged that being able to control internet usage to that extent is very near impossible without overreaching. So what the intent of the proposal is to create awareness on the real-world impact of doxing. This is especially important at the moment after the recent leaking of personal information from a WhatsApp group chat of Jewish Australian academics. This was done by Palestinian activists who leaked the chat with the intent of public interest, as the group chat was allegedly systematically doxing anti-Zionist activists. This highlighted an issue of the concept of public interest and how when it does get politicized, it can very quickly become hypocritical, of how public interest can be a very subjective concept. Rob Cover did suggest an independent body to assess these claims, which would address potential disputes with whichever political party is active at that time. Due to this, the prevailing strategy will more than likely be prevention tactics to make sure that internet users are aware of the consequences that doxing has outside of the digital landscape. As for the private sector, Rob Cover stated that the issue of doxing will more than likely come under employment law and in how businesses will establish safety protocols.
Ewan, thank you so much for this fascinating segment.
Just shortly, we'll be joined by Shane McArdle, Manager of International Projects at Sydney's Asbestos and Dust Diseases Research Institute, to get the skinny on the asbestos mulch situation.
Let there be 1,000 blossoms bloom, as far as I'm concerned.
Back on Backchat. And Nick, you just told me that you live in a building with asbestos, which means you have something in common with a lot of bugs all over Sydney who woke up to find their building, mulch, covered in asbestos as well.
That is correct. Thankfully for me, like many homes in Australia, the asbestos in my building is safely sealed away. I think actually people would be pretty surprised how many buildings have asbestos in them in Sydney. I'm also incredibly surprised at how many parks have asbestos in them. I feel like everywhere I drive, everywhere I walk in Sydney, I'm just seeing
yellow
taped
tape
off mulch. Yeah, it's really quite concerning, actually, because this all started with some mulch in a public park, which was found to be contaminated with bonded asbestos, and has since been identified at close to 50 public locations, and it's actually caused the cancellation of Mardi Gras Fair Day, which is really sad.
Boo!
Yeah.
Look, we are joined by Shane McArdle from the Asbestos and Dust Diseases Research Institute for the lowdown on how worried you should be. Shane, hello, welcome.
Hi, Holly. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hey. Look, let's start at the start. What is asbestos and how did it make the journey to our mulch?
Well, asbestos is a naturally occurring mineral that was mined for many years in Australia and also overseas. And it was used in dozens of building products, also engine parts. So it's very prevalent in a lot of areas, and we have Australia was one of the highest per capita users of asbestos for decades until the early 1980s. So we have a huge legacy issue with asbestos that is aging. How it ended up in mulch is also interesting, that a lot of older buildings that are being demolished may have asbestos in them, and that has ended up in through the recycling of building materials has ended up in mulch, and that's been distributed to parks across Sydney. And also it's now been found in the ACT as well.
Mm. You were talking just then about recycling of building materials and how that asbestos is making it into mulch. So this is clearly not how asbestos is meant to be disposed of. What are people meant to do with it?
Well, if people find asbestos materials, then the best thing is to, you know, not panic, but probably put a mask on and gloves, put it in a plastic bag or wrap it in plastic and put it away somewhere. That's the quickest way to isolate it and get it away from anywhere. near yourselves or your people that live around you. But the best way is, and we recommend that you get a licensed asbestos removalist to come in, assess the problem, and then take it away for you. But obviously, if it's a couple of little pieces that you find in the back garden or somewhere, then that does it does incur an expense that people may not be willing to make. But the best way is just to remove it, put it away, wrap it in plastic, and leave it somewhere where it's not going to be disturbed.
Yeah, look, we've also heard, I guess I've heard anecdotally, that some of the added expense of disposing asbestos kind of puts people off doing it properly.
It does, and also we have had instances of contractors that are not licensed that are removing asbestos and then illegally dumping it in places where it does become a risk and a harm to others. There is a limit on where people can dispose of asbestos. That's why we recommend that you get a licensed removalist in, because then they can remove it safely and then take it away and dispose of it legally, and then it's gone. But the regulation does sort of limit the ability for people to remove it and to dispose of it, but that's something that's really for the state government to respond to.
And so there are two different types of asbestos at play, right? There's bonded and friable. Could you tell us a bit about what the difference is?
Well, it's really the asbestos is the same. It's just the way it appears. I mean, bonded asbestos is that sort of asbestos sheeting that you see, and you might see fragments of it where it's bonded in a cement mix. So the fibres are still bonded in that that cement. But the problem is when that starts to deteriorate, then the fibres are released, and that's where you get exposures happen. Friable asbestos is a much more dangerous sort of situation where it is, it's actually crumbling, and you can crumble it in your hands if you were to do it. That way, you're far more liable to be exposed to asbestos fibres if it's friable. It's not as common as bonded asbestos, but it has been found in some of the parks in those locations.
You are listening to Backchat on FBI Radio, and you can text in on 0409 945 945. Right now, we're chatting with Shane McArdle from the Asbestos and Dust Diseases Research Institute about what some papers are calling the asbestos mulch crisis. Tell us about some of the risks of asbestos, Shane.
Well, if you're exposed to asbestos, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to end up with an asbestos disease. The latency period between exposure and the possibility of a disease could be up to 40, even 50 years. So it's not something that you will see immediately if you are exposed to asbestos. And there's no tests to tell if you have been exposed and what possibly could happen in the future. Mesothelioma is the most aggressive form of asbestos disease, and that's still pretty rare, but it does cause the deaths of over 700 people in Australia every year. And also, from all forms of asbestos diseases, up to 4,000 people die from that, from the disease, those diseases each year, which, as you would probably imagine, it's more than double the road toll. So it is a risk at being exposed to asbestos, but it is still a rare disease or diseases to be affected with.
And if the city has potentially identified asbestos at your local park, somewhere where you spend a couple of hours each week maybe, is that something that you should be worried about, that level of exposure?
Well, the bonded asbestos in the parks, in the mulch, is considered very low risk because it is away from the public. It's not close, unless someone goes in and disturbs the asbestos and then stirs it up and breaks it or damages it, then it's not a high risk. It's very low risk, but the you know, as I said, when it does get broken down and it does deteriorate, the fibres are released, then it does create a more of a problem for... But so if you were in a park with and there was asbestos in the mulch, you know, several metres away, I wouldn't worry. But if someone was to, say, a dog was to go in and dig up that mulch and spread it around, then that does cause a bit more of a risk. If someone sees any asbestos in the park or whatever, call their local council because they will come over and remove it. But yeah, it's still considered very low risk if it's just in the garden bed or away from public areas.
This is a bit off topic. I don't know how much you can answer this, but I've been wondering about, you know, dogs are smaller, and if they've been digging in the mulch, can they develop mesothelioma?
They actually can. Then there has been cases, but because obviously dogs have a lot of other things happen to them over this, and because they have a much shorter lifespan, it's not picked up as it would be in humans, but there has been cases in the past of dogs being diagnosed with asbestos diseases. It can happen, but like with humans, it's very rare, and it's very difficult to pick up.
Okay, well, I'll try not to be too stressed about that. Look, there's also been a bit of talk that there might be overscreening at play, that basically asbestos was already all over the place and we're just finding it now because we are looking. Is there substance to that?
Well, there could possibly be because of the you know, the media attention on the bonded asbestos in the mulch. But yeah, I do agree that there's probably a fair bit of asbestos out there in the, you know, because we were such a high user of asbestos, and back in the day when before garbage collection, then people just buried stuff in their backyards and practices like that. So you may find, you know, certainly, you know, in built up areas that there might be something out there, but as long as it stays in the backyard and it's not dug up, then it's there's no real risk to it. But I think, yeah, because this has arisen recently, then I think the media, that there is a lot more attention on the presence of asbestos in our built environment. And you know, say that the records show that one in three houses across Australia may contain asbestos because of the year that it was built and the materials that were used back then. So there is a good possibility that if you live in, say, Marrickville or other areas, like older areas, then there's likely to be asbestos somewhere, you know, possibly, you know, lying around. But as long as you don't disturb it, then everything should be pretty safe.
Shane, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, Shane. Next up, we'll hear from Dr. Skye McGregor and Jack Freestone about the syphilis epidemic sweeping through Australia.
Back chat.
Your alternative to talk back.
On FBI 94.5.
So, Nick, this week you've taken a bit of a look at the current syphilis outbreak in Australia.
That's right, Holly. If you've been watching the news lately, you may have noticed some talk about the absolute explosion in case numbers over the last couple of years. But when you dig a little bit deeper, this has actually been building for quite a while.
When you think of syphilis, what comes to mind? For a lot of people, it's historical figures like Benjamin Franklin, Abraham Lincoln, and even Blackbeard the pirate, all of whom supposedly caught the disease back in their days. So it might surprise you to find out that in the modern day, case numbers are going through the roof. You don't have to go back too far to find a time when syphilis was close to being completely eradicated, but in the last decade, case numbers have exploded. And it's only in recent weeks that the media is starting to pay attention.
Here in Florida, syphilis cases are spiking, reaching their highest levels in decades.
Last year, syphilis killed four babies in Queensland.
Canada's top doctor is warning people about the sharp increase in syphilis cases.
Syphilis rates are soaring in America.
The number of syphilis cases in the United States is the highest it's been since the 1950s.
Now, this massive increase in cases might seem surprising to you, but for sexually and gender-diverse Australians, as well as First Nations peoples living in remote communities, the syphilis epidemic is all too familiar. So why are we only now hearing so much about syphilis in the news?
You can't deny that not just for syphilis, but for many issues, when it hits certain populations, you get more media attention.
The voice you just heard is Dr. Skye McGregor. She's an epidemiologist and senior research fellow at UNSW's Kirby Institute. And she has a lot to say about the current state of syphilis infections in Australia.
We've seen over the last 10 years a substantial increase in sexually transmissible infections, or STIs, in Australia. And so our chlamydia accounts for the largest number of diagnoses in Australia, followed by gonorrhea. It's syphilis where we've seen the dramatic increase. So we've seen a tripling in notifications in the last 10 years, when not that long ago we were talking about eliminating syphilis in Australia.
To put that into perspective, in 2013, the Kirby Institute found that just under 2,000 people had been diagnosed with syphilis. By 2022, that number had risen to well over 6,000. And the numbers are even more shocking when you look at just women. In 2013, women accounted for under 150 cases across the country. 10 years later, that number has risen to over 1,000. So what's happened over the last decade to get us to this point?
2009, we were talking about eradicating syphilis in Australia, and that was because of really high uptake of testing and treatment, particularly in remote Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And what we saw is in 2011, there was an increase, and we first saw that in Queensland, detected an increase in the number of cases. And that outbreak, as we now characterise it, then spread through remote areas in other parts of Australia, so Northern Territory, far north Queensland, Western Australia and South Australia. And really, it's the same as what we're seeing across the world. As lots of places thought they were very close to eliminating it. There's a highly effective antibiotic for treating syphilis. But we've seen that resurgence in many places across the world. And it's really concerning because the impacts of syphilis are considerable.
One key impact that has been drawing a significant amount of media attention is congenital syphilis. This occurs when a child is infected with syphilis in the womb, and it can have pretty devastating impacts, including miscarriage, stillbirth, and other birth defects. The statistics of congenital syphilis are particularly disappointing in First Nations communities. 60% of congenital syphilis cases in Australia are observed in First Nations mothers, despite only 5% of Australian births originating from these communities. Dr. McGregor says congenital syphilis is completely preventable, and the media can be doing a better job to highlight these issues when they're affecting vulnerable communities.
I think media has a responsibility to report on this in a nuanced way. Stigma and discrimination is real. It's still there. Stigma around sexual health still persists, and it stops people from seeking out healthcare and having discussions with their sexual partners. We should be able to do that in a really open way, and I think the media have a role in removing that stigma, having open and transparent discussions around sexual health. You know, we now happily talk about COVID and influenza and things, but we still haven't got to the point where we can happily talk about sexual health and STIs. And what we should be doing is talking to our sexual partners about it. We should be getting regularly tested, and we should feel comfortable telling them if we test positive too, so that they can go and get tested as well.
Another person who believes the mainstream media should be working to educate and destigmatise STIs like syphilis is Jack Freestone. Jack is the manager of Gay and Bisexual Men and Men Who Have Sex with Men programs at ACOM, which is a Sydney-based community organisation specialising in LGBTQ plus health.
I think the most important thing in a medical crisis is that communities who are affected have access to timely, evidence-based, non-stigmatising information. And I think the mainstream media can play a role in supporting that function, but I think that the responsibility around that function largely sits with government, community organisations and affected communities themselves.
One such community organisation is ACON, which consistently advocates for testing and awareness for those that may be at higher risk of STI infection.
Testing is really important. So comprehensive STI testing for HIV and STIs. The current guidelines on that are that if you're having multiple casual partners and you're a gay or bisexual man, you should test every 3 months. If you're in a monogamous relationship, one time a year is enough.
Testing is of particular importance around periods like Mardi Gras, which is well underway in Sydney. Due to a number of factors, the end of summer is a period that sees a rise in cases, continuing to emphasise the importance of education and regular testing.
Mardi Gras is a really special time for our communities, and it's also a time when people might feel a little bit more affectionate and popular with each other. You know, it's the end of summer, people are in a good mood, and I think we probably do see heightened sexual activity throughout that celebration. We have seen increased sexually transmitted infections around these big events, But again, we've also seen increased service provision around these big event seasons. We've also, in the lead up to Mardi Gras every year, we do a really strong testing campaign. We've got a campaign out in the streets now in Sydney and across New South Wales called Let's Test. It's really cute. The colours are really fresh. You'll see it around. So we see more people coming forward for testing because of more services being available and because of more promotion. So it's that double-edged sword of more sexual activity, more promotion, more services available, and increase rates of STIs.
Despite the concerning rise in case numbers, both Dr. Skye McGregor and Jack Freestone reiterated that with regular testing and an emphasis on the importance of sexual healthcare, syphilis can once again become a thing of the past.
If you're a member of the LGBTQI+ community, or you just want to find out more about sexual healthcare, you can head to ACON, that's ACON.org.au.
Let us know what you think. Does the media do a good enough job of covering health stories, especially in vulnerable communities? Text in 0409 945 945. But that is all we have time for.
Of course, a big thanks to our guests Rob Cover, Dr. Skye McGregor, Jack Freestone and Shane McArdle.
And a bigger thanks to our producers, Tanita Rezaghi, Beck Cushway, and Ewan Kiley. This has been Back Chat. We'll be back with the news from your city and beyond next week. But until then, stay tuned for Limbs Akimbo, up now.
Back Chat is produced by FBI Radio in Sydney. Tune in live every Saturday at 9:30 a.m. Find more at fbiradio.com/backchat.